Hello, Keri Phillips here with Rear Vision. Today, the Tartan Revolution, independence for Scotland.
We need real power and a real parliament. We need a real parliament that can use our resources to build this country anew. We need a real parliament to represent the real Scotland. We need independence. It is independence that will allow us to make our own decisions about our own future. And it is independence that will give us the confidence to take responsibility for those decisions.
The Scottish actor Sean Connery, a long-time champion of Scottish independence. In just a few days, the people of Scotland will decide in a referendum whether or not they want to remain part of the United Kingdom or strike out on their own as an independent nation. 300 years ago, Scotland was an independent country, and it's this, according to David McCrone, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Edinburgh, that has inevitably carried them to this month's vote.
Because when Scotland and England created Great Britain in 1707, over 300 years ago, Scotland was always autonomous. So it had a degree of independence, that is, with a small I, not formally, because of course the Scottish Parliament ceased to exist, but then so did the English Parliament, and a British one was created. So in a way, it's never really gone away. It was always underlying the nature of the United Kingdom, which, although for a long time was a unitary state with a single legislature in London, was always a multinational state. So there was a kind of conundrum, a dilemma at the heart of the British state, which was that although power was all vested in London, in the UK Parliament, actually the countries of Scotland, Wales, Ireland at the time, and England were different. They had their own sense of identity, and for a long time that actually held, and actually far longer than in retrospect we thought it would. So it's not gone away. But nevertheless, formal independence, that is, independence with a capital I, really comes on the scene with the emergence of the Scottish National Party in the middle of the 1970s. And the Scottish National Party, which had been formed in the 1920s, was a kind of small, somewhat eccentric party, a cultural party, I suppose, really benefited from the discovery of oil in the North Sea and hit on the slogan, it's Scotland's oil. It wasn't legally Scotland's oil, but it certainly was, if you like, morally, they said, Scotland's oil. And therefore, at a stroke in many ways, it wiped out the rationale for the union, which is that Scotland was better off allegedly within the United Kingdom rather than outside it. So it opened up the possibility of independence, and indeed the SNP came from virtually nothing in the polls to 30% in the 1970s.
These low rumblings of Scottish nationalism were noted by the British Labour Party, which has traditionally relied on winning almost all the Scottish seats to gain office in Westminster. So when Labour returned to government in 1997, after the long Thatcher era, it allowed the Scots a referendum on a Scottish Parliament, hoping this would be enough to keep a lid on the demand for complete independence. The vote went 3-1 in favour of devolution, and in 1999, the Queen opened a new Scottish Parliament.
My prayers are with you all as you embark on this new and historic journey, and I am confident in the future of Scotland. I am pleased, therefore, now to declare the Scottish Parliament open, and in so doing, to present to you this newly commissioned mace, a modern embodiment of an ancient symbol of power, legitimacy, and the relationship between Parliament and Crown.
Up on Calton Hill above the city, thousands of people from Edinburgh and beyond danced late into the night around a huge bonfire to celebrate the imminent return of home rule after an absence of nearly 300 years.
We feel magnificent. It's the first time in 300 blessed years, and we feel great.
It gave people in Scotland direct control of domestic affairs, of health and education, of law and order. And of course, there was a legal system which always had existed, but it was control over domestic affairs. Now, domestic affairs, health, schools, law and order, and so on, policing, all of these things matter to people. Indeed, you might say they matter more to people because the here and now, they affect directly people's lives. So very quickly, the Scottish Parliament became the Parliament in people's eyes. And indeed, the Westminster politicians, who were left with control over macroeconomic policy and foreign affairs and defence and all those sorts of things, discovered very quickly that they dropped out of the media attention. That although it was, as it were, the big parliament, people in Scotland saw the Scottish Parliament as the local parliament and the one that really mattered. So there was always a dynamic, particularly since 1999. There was a parliament. The parliament was, in the early days, controlled by Labour and the Liberal Democrats, who in many respects had been the architects of devolution, as we called it. But they lost power in 2007. The SNP formed a minority government in 2007. People in Scotland thought they had done a reasonably good job, and to everyone's surprise, and I suspect also the Nationalists, they were swept to power with an overall majority in 2011.
Although the vote for the SNP in 2011 can't be seen as a direct reflection of the level of support for independence, the party's astonishing outright win under a voting system designed to always produce coalition governments gave them the moral authority to press the UK government for a referendum on the issue. As with Australia's referendum on a republic in 1999, there was plenty of argument over just what the question should be, although both governments eventually agreed on the question, should Scotland be an independent country? Neither side was totally happy, though, according to John Curtis, Professor of Politics at the University of Strathclyde. The major UK political parties, favouring union, had wanted the question to be framed so they could campaign for a yes vote, while the SNP could see that a vote for complete independence would be hard to pull off.
The referendum on the 8th of September is, formally at least, simply about whether or not Scotland becomes an independent country. However, the Scottish government, since it first came to power in the form of the SNP in 2007, had gradually come to the realisation that maybe actually there wasn't necessarily support, majority support for independence in Scotland, but various consultation exercises in which it engaged, it hit upon the fact, well, actually maybe Scotland was up for having its Scottish Parliament being more powerful than it is at the moment, and particularly in the two areas of domestic responsibility that are still primarily the responsibility of the UK House of Commons, that is taxation and welfare. Survey evidence suggested that actually asked people in Scotland who should be making decisions for these for Scotland, and they were tending to say the Scottish Parliament. Given that appreciation that maybe what became known as maximum devolution or Devo Max may well have majority support, the SNP had long played with the idea of, well, actually maybe the referendum, rather than just simply being about independence, should be a choice between independence, devolution max, and the status quo. Now, the one thing that the UK government insisted on, and in the end, frankly, it was the only thing it insisted on, is, oh, no. The one thing we want this referendum to simply be about is independence or not. We don't want the issue of more devolution to also appear on the ballot paper. Now, there were a variety of reasons. This partly technical. It is indeed rather more difficult to hold a referendum which gives you a clear decision if you're asking people to choose between three options rather than two. But also, I think it was political. The first is that actually the UK parties, at least at that stage 2 years ago, had not agreed as to what may or may not happen in the way of more devolution. And above all, given that for the UK government, the principal aim of this exercise was indeed to inflict a defeat on the Scottish National Party, if the idea of more devolution should be on the ballot paper, then okay, independence might be lost, but if more devolution were to be won, then the SNP would have got, as they openly admitted, a consolation prize. So a mixture of technical and the political meant that the UK government said, no, this is not going to be on the ballot paper. Now, however, ironically, actually, themselves being not unaware of the apparent pressure for the Scottish Parliament to be more powerful, all three of the principal political parties campaigning for a no vote, those are the UK-wide parties, the Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democrat parties, all of them now actually come up with plans for more devolution. Now, I don't think anybody would describe them as devolution max. They are some further taxation powers, some much more limited welfare benefit responsibilities, but still a clear step in that direction. And indeed, they are now telling us that a vote for no won't simply mean the status quo, but that actually these ideas for further devolution would be implemented. Now, the only trouble is we're not quite sure which ones would be implemented because the three parties have come up with three different proposals. But so therefore, what we do seem to be in, at least if we accept the promises of the no those side, is that although actually more devolution is not on the ballot paper, apparently that actually is now one of the choices before Scotland, and that actually the referendum is, rather than a choice between the status quo and independence, is a choice between independence and more devolution. Politics is a funny game, and the convoluted story of this referendum is probably certainly one of the funnier ones.
Once the date and the question were settled and the necessary bills passed in Parliament, the SNP released a mammoth 600-page white paper setting out its aspirations for the future. Alan Taylor writes for the Herald and the Sunday Herald and is the editor of the Scottish Review of Books.
Well, that document was called Scotland's Future, and there's essentially a white paper that mapped out all the different areas that the SNP saw would be Scotland's future under an independent country. So these covered everything from health, education, defence, diplomacy, culture, you name it, the currency. Everything was covered in that document. It was a Booker-sized novel of a document. And of course, that document's been much pored over. But interestingly, the people who are against independence haven't produced a similar document.
Was that document seized on with enthusiasm by people in Scotland? Did people actually take the time to read what was in it?
Well, this is the incredible thing. They did. The document, which was made freely available to anybody who wanted it, that quickly became unavailable because so many people did want to get their hands on it. So you could actually get the document yourself and read it as a book at home. But you could also read it online as and when you wanted to do that. But my experience tells me that, lots of people have read it and been keen to read it because they want to gen up on this. My own daughter, who's now 30 and has never knowingly read a book about politics at all, has taken my copy away, and I'm finding it very difficult to get back.
So it was seized on with enthusiasm by people. Did it actually answer everyone's questions, do you think?
No, it was never going to do that. It was a document that the SNP put together, and it was their vision of Scotland's future. It wasn't everybody's vision of Scotland's future, it was their vision of Scotland's future. But the interesting thing, I think, about it was that it provided the basis for an argument, and therefore people could look at that and say, well, that's their ideas, but these are our ideas. And so people have used that as the basis on which to build something else. And I don't think anybody would say that that document is a writ of law. I think it is the basis of something. But I mean, what was interesting about it was that people had taken the time to think about what Scotland would be like in an independent future. And I think from that point of view, it was extremely valuable. And I think it set a good marker for the campaign. It was something that people could get their teeth into.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. And one of the unusual features of the Campaign for Scotland's Independence referendum has been the extraordinary degree to which it's engaged people. I spoke by Skype to Chris Whatley, Professor of Scottish History at the University of Dundee.
The right way of expressing my feeling on that would be amazement. In Scotland, in the UK, and I don't know about Australia, but certainly until this referendum, it looked like the political meeting was dead. People just didn't turn out for political meetings. You know, you would get, in terms of the political parties, you know, very small numbers turning up at ward and constituency meetings. Even big politicians didn't attract big audiences. What is striking, remarkable about what's been going on in the last couple of years is the degree to which the public has been engaged in the debate. And what's I think also, it's not amazing, but certainly what's very positive is the way in which ordinary people are coming out and engaging with serious issues. It's not just yaboo politics, yes versus no. There's some fairly intelligent, searching discussion taking place about what it means to be Scottish, about just what the issues in terms of welfare in Scotland are, whether that's within the United Kingdom or outside in an independent Scotland. So issues are being discussed. Lots of people are involved in these discussions. And the prediction is, when it comes to the 18th of September, and this is the proof of the pudding, if you like, the predictions are there's going to be a remarkably high turnout, perhaps as high as 80%, which is incredible when you consider that at the last Scottish government elections, the figure was something like 50%. So 80% turnout would be remarkable.
Well, the debate at a grassroots level has been totally phenomenal. There are public debates happening all over the country, in town halls, churches, libraries, universities, within businesses, some formally organised, others internally organised. And these are attended by hundreds of people. They're packed out, standing room only affairs. Sometimes they're completely one-sided, so they're just people from the yes side or the no side talking. Sometimes they're mixed in their proper debates. It may just be a debate about the economy or culture or education or the health service. But the level of engagement has been truly amazing. And then, of course, you've got this sort of street-level debate where the various parties are out in the street petitioning and arguing and discussing with people. And then you've got debates within families and you have debates with friends. I was in my local pub last night, and within 10 minutes of me being in there, there was a great heated debate about the televised debate that was on Monday night. So this is something that is at the forefront of people's mind in Scotland. No matter where you go, no matter how immune you think you are from this debate, suddenly it springs up and it's governing what everybody thinks. This is really about their future, but it's also about their children's future, and it's about the future direction of the country. It is a chance, actually, to remake and reinvent Scotland.
While the Better Together side has argued for the known certainties of union, those for independence are asking voters to take a big step into the unknown. And as the debate over Scotland's future has intensified, two economic issues have generated much heat. The first is North Sea oil, the vital source of an independent Scotland's income. Alex Salmond argues there's enough to set up a sovereign wealth fund similar to Norway's to ensure Scotland's future prosperity, while the opposition argues that it's a dwindling resource that will become more difficult to recover. The second is the SNP's intention to keep the British pound as currency. The three main parties at Westminster have officially ruled out sharing sterling with an independent Scotland.
They can't stop Scotland keeping the pound. That's the first thing one should emphasise. They can't stop Scotland keeping the pound. It's how the pound is run is what the argument is about. It's as much Scotland's pound as it is England's pound. It's a question of how that currency is governed and run, who sets interest rates, etc. And that's what the argument is about. And the problem has been for the Yes campaign in saying that is that the No campaign and David Cameron at Westminster says, we are not going to negotiate that at the moment and we're not going to talk about it. So it's very difficult for the Yes campaign to say, well, this is what will happen when the other side won't negotiate. But you did say there that, you know, there's a risk and, of course, a leap of faith into the dark or whatever. But similarly, it's a leap of faith and a leap into the dark if we stay within the UK. For example, the UK government have said that if they're re-elected, they will hold a referendum on staying in the European Union. Now, if in 2 years' time the UK votes to go out of the European Union, what about the risk then? What about the uncertainty then? Scotland doesn't want to leave the European Union, but it would leave the European Union if the rest of the UK said, we're leaving the European Union. So Scots would get something they don't want.
Amongst the factors that seem to me to be playing to the public are the prospect of a Tory-free Scotland. In other words, there's been a great deal of resentment, or certainly resentment has been drummed up about the fact that we've had, since Mrs. Thatcher really, a number of Conservative governments which the Scots didn't vote for, and that the Scots have some different values, if you like, and would have done things differently. There is also a strong feeling, certainly it goes down well at public meetings, that Scotland can be nuclear free. That is, that the UK nuclear submarine base at Faslane would be closed and the nuclear submarines would be sent south of the border somewhere. Something which raises cheers at public meetings I've attended has been the idea that Scotland could be a more prosperous society. That is, if the Scottish Government had more economic levers, Scotland could be more business-friendly, could be more competitive. And allied to that is the notion that Scotland could be a fairer society, that there would be a reversal of Westminster social policy, if you like, which is seen to be, which is actually doing great damage in terms of unemployed people, people with disabilities and so forth. So there is this belief that Scotland, an independent Scotland, could be more prosperous, would have control over its own destiny, and that different Scottish political social values would be part of the mix, if you like. So there's quite a captivating story, if you like, or narrative on the part of the Yes campaign. Although, as I say, as yet, the majority of the electorate, according to opinion polls, are not yet persuaded. And there is this majority, it's not huge, but a majority thus far for staying within the United Kingdom. And one of the reasons for that is there is a section of Scottish society which feels more British than Scottish, if you like. And there is a great deal of concern, uncertainty, about just what an independent Scotland would be like. There is concern that the issue of what currency Scotland would use after independence, that's not been resolved. There are issues to do with oil. Right now, there's a big, intense debate taking place about how much oil there is left in the North Sea and what value that oil would be to a Scottish treasury. So on the no side, if you like, the no side are emphasising the uncertainties of independence and are arguing that we'd be better off within the United Kingdom in the sense that if things go wrong, say, for example, the price of oil fell dramatically, the UK Treasury would be able to continue to maintain public spending in a way that might not be possible in independent Scotland.
Although some people have argued that the rest of the UK should also be allowed to vote on Scottish independence on the grounds that it would affect the whole country, only those living and registered to vote in Scotland will be able to. This includes British citizens as well as citizens from the EU and the Commonwealth living there. The Scottish Government also passed special legislation allowing 16-year-olds to vote.
When devolution was introduced in 1997, the Westminster Parliament said, well, we're just going to treat the Scottish Parliament as a local thing, and therefore rules of local political involvement will apply. At a UK level, you can only vote in UK general elections if you're a British citizen. But the Scottish Parliament elections are there really not as important as the UK Parliament elections, sovereign parliament and all that sort of thing. Now, what that meant was that it was a much more open system. That is, if people from, for example, came and lived here and worked here, even if they were not British citizens, if they were members, you know, if they were Poles or Italians or Spaniards or whatever, and there are many of those sorts of people around, they would have the right, registered to vote in the Scottish referendum, just as they have in the Scottish election. This led to a kind of a funny little spat of people who lived in England or indeed Australia. I was saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm a Scot, I have the right to vote. Well, you don't. You voted with your feet, you left, perfectly right. And lots of people voted with their feet in the other direction, came in and have become, if you like, for the sake of argument, political Scots. That is, with the right to vote in the election. So there's the electoral register. It is a simple plurality of votes. One vote is enough. Now, one vote would make it really very, very interesting either way. In political terms, the greater the gap between yes and no, certain things would happen. If it, for example, if it's a marginal yes, then is that a mandate for independence? Well, theoretically, yes. But if we take that as unlikely, which I think in statistical terms is unlikely, and it's a no, if there's an overall no vote of 55 to 45, then you're really left with a substantial minority of people who are in favour of independence. If it is, let's call it 70-30, I think that's unlikely, but in favour of no, then clearly it's off the agenda. That's a defeat. But the issue is how close it is will determine how things pan out in the future, particularly in the grassroots of Scottish civil society. There is a considerable amount, you know, below the radar, if you like, discussion of what kind of Scotland people want to have. I know a lot of Labour supporters who said, no, we need to get back to what they call real politics, you know, the politics of distribution and health. But actually, this is the real politics. They're fooling themselves if they think this is no longer real politics. Because who controls spending on health and education and welfare actually really, really does matter. So it's not going to go away. So there's no sense, although they would like to think that all of this is back in the cupboard and we don't have to worry about that anymore, things can never be the same again. To use Yeats's term, things have changed utterly.
Independence for Scotland would have enormous implications for the major political parties at Westminster, especially Labour. Scotland has 59 seats at Westminster, predominantly held by Labour Party members.
If Scotland were to become independent, you could not have Scottish MPs at Westminster. Now, if you didn't have Scottish MPs at Westminster, at a stroke, the Labour Party in the UK would lose 50 MPs. Well, that would virtually guarantee a perpetual Tory government in London. Well, you can imagine, the Labour Party does not want that to happen. So it is desperate to retain the union.
There's been relatively little interest in Scotland from south of the border ever, really. I mean, England gets on with its own thing and pays attention to Scotland when it revolts, as in the Jacobite Risings of the early 18th century, and perhaps now, as they appear to be threatening the future of the United Kingdom. But it will affect England too enormously, because the Scots, alongside their brothers and sisters of England, have made Britain, made the United Kingdom, and there is a feeling that we would all be, that is, all the citizens of the British Isles would be weaker, would be less, if Scotland pulled out of the United Kingdom. And of course, then it raises issues of the extent to which what would be then the rest of the United Kingdom would have an influence in the rest of the world. I mean, the United Kingdom is understood as Scotland, England, part of Ireland and Wales. Without Scotland, it is a lesser being. And that, I think, is being recognised now, as I say, in government circles south of the border as well.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. And as the vote draws closer, polls show the difference between the two sides narrowing, with the no side support slipping, although there's still a significant 10 to 15% undecided.
Who'll win on the 18th of September? Well, today, if I'm reading the polls aright, it would suggest that it's going to be close, but that no will win. Some polls are suggesting it'll be a 60-40 division in favour of no. I would be shocked if that's the case. I think it'll be something like 53 no and 47, even higher, yes. But I'm guessing. But that's my reading of of the streets, if you like, or opinion and the people I talk with. In fact, to be perfectly frank with you, I've spoken at many public meetings in the last couple of years. I've attended even more. And I haven't been to a meeting yet where there's been a majority in favour of no. So the no voters are being very quiet and perhaps staying at home, and perhaps because they're a bit concerned about speaking out. So to go back to your question, my prediction is that there will be a narrow no vote. But of course, that could change because the campaign is really hotting up now, and who knows what will be said. I think that much of the debate hitherto has been based on head, if you like. It's been about issues and facts and so forth. It'll be interesting to see the extent to which heart and passion and the question of Scottish identity, it'll be interesting to see how important that plays out. I think there will be appeals to Scottish patriotism and all of that. And that's a pretty powerful force in Scotland. And it even makes the hearts of no supporters beat more rapidly.
Chris Whatley from the University of Dundee. On the program today, you also heard polling expert John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde, David McCrone from the University of Edinburgh, and Alan Taylor from the Herald Scotland. If you want to know how Scotland gave up its sovereignty in the first place, just go to the Rear Vision webpage and look for our special features. I've put up a link to a couple of Rear Visions you might find interesting. On the story page for this program, there's also a link to the SNP's 600-page white paper, Scotland's Future, if you really want to be the complete expert. Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. Bye from Keri Phillips.
For me, Scotland has always been and always will be a different country. A country that had a different language, different legal system, a different educational system.
And different values. That's the important thing about our cultural identity. We have different values from England. And the common links that unite the different viewpoints of, say, Scottish working class, Scottish middle class, Scottish upper class, are quite a strong link in terms of making us Scottish. There's much more uniting us than there is dividing us.